everyone. Welcome back to Behind the Science of Career Development. I am your host, Brian Hutchison, aka the Global Career Guy. And I am just really excited to spend some time today with Dr. Jim Bright, one of the founders of Chaos Theory of Careers, and of course, one of the authors of the lead article in the most recent issue, a special issue on Chaos Theory of Careers in the Asia Pacific Career Development Journal. So Jim, thank you so much for taking some time with us today. And I always let guests sort of introduce themselves as they wish the audience to know them.
Well, thank you, Brian, and thank you for inviting me to be involved, and also for the association for putting out the special edition. And it's exciting that the ideas and the work is having some impact and other people are picking up on the ideas. I often say, as a joke at the beginning of sort of 3 or 4 day training programs, that first of all, I'll talk a little bit about myself, and then on the fourth day, we might do some work. So stop me if I rattle on about my favorite topic. I'm joking. What can I say about myself? I have a portfolio career. I'm a psychologist with a specialization in organizational psychology. That was my training. I now have multiple positions. I have an academic part-time position as a professorial fellow in career education and development at Australian Catholic University, just campuses all over Australia and also in Rome. Before that, I was in the School of Psychology at the University of New South Wales, and before that, was trained in the UK. So that's my academic side. I also have for 30 years or more, been a consultant and a practitioner in the field. Ran my own career counselling and career development and coaching practice, training other people. I still work actively with clients on a daily basis in the medical legal sphere. So I'm working with people who have been injured or hurt on duty or traumatised or bullied or harassed, and are making legal claims and insurance claims. So I go to court and do that kind of work, which is very specialised, unusual kind of work, I think, for our field. I occasionally still do talks and speaking around the place. When those opportunities arise, I write a column in an Australian newspaper, the Sydney Morning Herald. It's also in The Age in Melbourne, and it's syndicated around the country, and you can read it around the world. And on LinkedIn, link in with me and you'll get a connection to that. What else do I do? I think that's covered a fair way. Oh, and also, of course, I am the Director of Research and Impact for Become Education, which is a ed tech startup company developing really interesting stuff based on the Chaos Theory of Careers for career education programs from primary school upwards. And we're working around the world with that, with some really innovative stuff. That's Become Education. And that's become a major focus for me. And I still supervise research, masters and PhD students as well, continue to research.
Good. Yeah. So a man with probably lots of time on your hands, it sounds like.
A man who gets easily distracted or bored, I think, possibly. and can't say no. And that's probably, the rationale. Yeah. I think there was an English jazz musician, Humphrey Littleton, who also was a restaurant critic and also a cartoonist in newspapers and a radio broadcaster. And his attitude was always, in terms of careers advice, always say yes and then work out how to do it afterwards. It doesn't work for everybody, but if you have a certain degree of skill and ability, then it's not a bad strategy.
Yeah. Now, I had the idea of maybe trying to find a way to send you a bottle of champagne in Australia, because if I'm counting correctly, are you close to having an important 20th anniversary with the Chaos Theory of Careers?
2023 will be the 20th anniversary of the first peer review publication. And in that year, we had two publications, one in the Australian Journal of Career Development and one in the Career Development Association of Australia journal, I suppose. It is the Australian Journal of Career Development. And that was the culmination of about 3 to 4 years of work that it's funny, I migrated to Australia in 1995 to take a job at the University of New South Wales. And I was introduced to this eccentric chap a few doors down from the office I was allocated by the name of Robert Pryor. And Robert Pryor was in the process of leaving, I think, once he realized I was arriving. And our paths kind of crossed. And one of my jobs was a rather tricky one of trying to pick his brains for all of his contacts with professional psychologists in Sydney. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't quite sure why I was doing this, but anyway, he proved to be generous with his time. But off he went. Fast forward a couple of years, and I moved to a particular part of Sydney and end up living on the same street as him, completely by chance. And we shared a few vocational interests. We're both lovers of cricket, and we started going to cricket together and so forth. And I brought him back in to the master's program in organizational psych I was teaching. And he was running a medical legal practice where he was seeing people who were experiencing completely unplanned events which had profound impacts on their lives, namely injury, mm-hmm. or illness. And this started influencing our thinking, and both of us were dissatisfied with what was going on in the field at the time and historically, and felt this didn't really reflect practice. That these sort of rather idealized ideas of people whittling down and narrowing down from a wide range of options to an ideal career or the one that fitted, and then somehow this was what they should do for the rest of their lives, disregarded the complexity of influences on people, all of the different things, whether it be parental expectation, whether it be the economy, whether it be the geography of where they lived and the labour market realities, and also didn't take into account this big elephant in the room, unplanned events, which sort of sideswipe people. I remember having this big meeting about all of this and sort of thinking with a few other associates and thinking, we've got to do something about it. And we had some really bright master's students around at the time who were very keen to pursue this in terms of their research. And that's what really kicked it off. And that was around about 1999, 2000. And off we went. And then we started publishing on this. And it's funny, we were really expecting this enormous pushback. And we were kind of in a sort of forward defensive position, sort of leaning forward, waiting to be pushed back. And we almost fell flat on our faces because it was kind of like, you know, we sort of invaded a new theoretical area expecting resistance and found we were welcomed in. And it was kind of like, because I think it really chimed with people's experiences. And that was great. So, and then we had a very great run of researching and publishing, and it continues to this day in different forms in different ways. So that's really where it came from. But yes, 20 years ago was the first, or 20 years next year was the first peer-reviewed paper.
Good. Well, congratulations on that. I've probably been, and you may not have known this, but I tend to stalk the theorist at conferences. That sort of worked with me. And so I've been attending your presentations for probably 12 to 15 years. And one of the most, what I'd like to do is ask you a couple of questions that are the most common questions that I answer from the group mm-hmm. that I'm sitting with as we walk out the door. And so the first one that comes to mind is I had the pleasure of getting to know John Krumbholz in the last 8 years of his life. Mm-hmm. And a common question is what is the difference, right? So we have this unplanned events of Krumbholz, his theory, and then we have chaos theory of careers. How do you help people, practitioners, understand how they're different and how they work together, maybe, and how they think about their work?
Yeah, and that's a really good question because it is a very common misconception because people, when they're trying to arrange, you know, everything in the pantheon, if I can use that expression. They look for similarities and they latch onto the chance events aspect. Yeah, I mean, John became a friend of mine as well, and I went out to visit him in Palo Alto and interviewed him for a podcast I used to do back in 2008. It's hilarious, but I remember turning up in the heart of Apple country and pulled out an iPod. and he looked at this thing with absolute amazement, said, "What's that?" And I was thinking, there he was at Stanford University. If he'd just gone out the boundary, he would have seen.
And he's probably one of the few people in the field where I would think that with the two of you in the room, you might be the quiet one. Maybe, just maybe.
Oh, it was always live. It was always lively. But I mean, you've got to remember, Rob Pryor could also, talk underwater. But it was great. And I remember. John saying at the time that he had toyed with ideas of chaos but never really known how to or where to take it. So people have been floating, you know, this idea had been in the zeitgeist a bit, and we've always said about the happenstance learning theory is, and we don't mean this in a pejorative or critical way, it's not a full account of career development. It is a series of practical steps to deal with the aftermath of chance events. It doesn't, for instance, give an account of why chance events occur or their mechanism, but it is very useful in terms of strategies for dealing with uncertainty and also dealing with the aftermath of chance events. So that's not to be dismissive, because that's a really major contribution. And John was one of the very first people to systematically champion chance events and point out that they had not been adequately researched in the field. And, you know, with lovely catchy titles like Serendipity is Not Serendipitous. And there were some nice things like that that were done at the time, and he continued to do. So chaos theory is much bigger than that. And in fact, this is a really important point that we talk about in the current special edition paper, is still to this day, people seem to overly associate chaos theory or equate it in its entirety as being about chance events. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, there are some commentators out there who are saying, well, you know, we don't give an account of the mechanism of chance events. And that is a misreading of our stuff. Very typically, they say that because they've not read the 2011 book, Chaos Theory of Careers. If you read that and you read the chapters on fractal patterns and emergence, or the chapter on attractors, or the chapter on complexity, the chaos and complexity theory provides a principled account of chance events, how they occur, how they can be manipulated, how they can be worked with. And that's all in that book. Yet still, there are people out there saying they've talked about them and researched them. And that's not the case. In particular, this notion recently that we've seen about career shocks talks about that. And I have a lot of problems with that concept, because it's reinforcing the notion of chance events being negative things.
Yeah.
Not the case.
Yeah, I want to follow up on that thread, because this is another conversation I often have when people ask me why chaos theory of careers is so important in my work. And I don't know if I know how to put this well, but so much of the theoretical work in career seems to begin at stimulus and then planning the response. And what I love about it is it actually maps out the why, right? The why that we are having this conversation, or the why that this conversation is so difficult, or the why that the stickiness of this conversation may not go forward for the rest of my life. And I think because we're not accustomed to the a priori part, right, the before part in the way that we approach this work, that can be a bit of a barrier for practitioners, right, or even students that are thinking about learning about career theory in general. And then, of course, we look at an article, we look at a book, or we hear a professor presenting to us, and they're using physics terms, if I can use myself as an example early on, rather ineloquently. So could you sort of like back us up and just sort of give us the 60-second to 5-minute commercial, maybe less than 5 minutes, it's a podcast, but like map out that before time for me of what chaos theory describes to us before we start the process of career decision making, career counseling.
Well, I like the metaphor of map out, because I think that is one of the most important things. And one of my favorite complexity theorists, David Snowden, increasingly is talking about first try to work out where you are, and then explore what might be the best next steps, and then review and go back. And immediately you see an iterative process, and you see an exploratory, curiosity-driven process, and you see one which, in fact, with a bit of reflection, includes inherent uncertainty. So where we start off in terms of the chaos or complexity work is you're already standing in chaos and complexity. You're in it already, and you need to start to recognize the limits of your control and the limits of your understanding of your situation. So these sort of lovely expressions, which seem so seductive, like first know yourself and then know the labor market. Mm-hmm. Well, you can spend your whole life trying to know yourself, and you'll never fully know yourself or anybody else or the world around you. Even the block around you is going to change. You know, the people in the neighborhood are going to change. You're never going to really know them. you know, and I've been living with them for 30 years. I didn't realize they're a serial killer. You know, it was a funny smell coming, but you know, I just thought that was their cooking or whatever. That's not a very tasteful, in every sense of the word, example. But the point is, there's inherent uncertainty and this idea of absolutism, this idea of you can fit into this, you can fit into the other, isn't the case. We need to take into account the fact that things are continually changing, including yourself, including your circumstances, including the environment, including the broader environment and things, more global things such as politics, economies, and also things like the environment. And we're just a very small part of all of that. So we start off from a much more sort of position of humility in all of this process, not one of personal change, not one of you are the center of the universe and the world will do my bidding, but rather somebody who is part of and enmeshed in a complex network, whether they like it or not. And all they can do is seek to influence that system rather than to manage it or control it. And they can influence it by taking small steps, undertaking small experiments, trying small projects, and continually reviewing. And it's not this set and forget kind of notion. And that, in essence, is what we're getting at. It's called the chaos theory of careers because it's not our idea. These ideas came from things like evolutionary biology, meteorology, and mathematics. And they, in fact, the term chaos theory, again, was a label that was used by mathematicians and meteorologists way 20, 30, 40 years before Rob Pryor and Jim Bright came along. Mm-hmm. What we did is we saw the relevance of that to providing a principled account of what's going on in the world of careers and in the world generally. And that's one, and it sounds a bit pompous and maybe a bit grand, but we think theories should give an account of reality. We think that's what a theory should be. If it's not, it's a heuristic. And I think there's a lot of these sort of quite useful techniques, but they're very limited in terms of, and they're usually driven towards practice, towards providing an outcome, towards providing a solution. And people are often frustrated with the chaos theory, thinking, well, you know, where's the test I can do to tell me which jobs I should be applying for or moving into? And we said, well, that's exactly the wrong starting point for this. And you're still stuck within a sort of a lineage that goes back to Parsons via Holland. And while that has got some utility, that is far from the complete picture. And it is not sufficient in our view if you want to set people up for making these decisions and equipping them with the right approach to be constantly exploring this and to realize they can't just set and forget their careers. And any experienced career counselor will tell you, if they're working with adults, the people who have set and forget their careers are the ones who have these enormous problems when they're made redundant, they lose their job, they get injured, there's some transformation, they have to move interstate because their significant other has got an opportunity somewhere else. Whatever it may be, whatever the life event may be, they've got to care for an elderly parent or a sick child or a relative, whatever happens in their life which changes things or just changes their roles through death, divorce, marriage, childbirth, whatever it happens to be, those things are not necessarily always predictable or planned. And certainly the impact of those things is not always predictable or planned. So there's inherent uncertainty because there are so many different factors to weigh. Now that's probably is more 5 minutes or more on it. I think you appreciate it's not something that can just be reduced to a really simplistic concept.
Right. And that's what I really think it's important, right? I think that human nature is, and I think that counseling sometimes enmeshes ourselves with this, is to turn away from the harder things. And I think the harder things are the more important things because they're the pathway almost to a better life. The metaphor that I use in my training is surfing, because I don't know how to swim. I never learned how to swim, and I love the ocean, and I love sitting there in awe and fear of the magnitude of waves. And then watching these people who seem crazy to me that actually paddle out into waves and jump on little pieces of wood and feel immense elation in coming to an agreement with both the power and the ferocity of the waves. And for me, particularly because I don't know how to swim, I use that as a metaphor because I want, you know, we have to find that line. If we want to do the hard, important work, we have to learn how to be there with our clients and make them feel supported and maintained while we're doing that hard work. And so I know that you're in practice. I know that you sit with clients every day. I would imagine that there's some shock when they finally wake up to the fact that chaos is all around them, that precarity is a constant. How do you sit with clients and sort of navigate the difficulty of this experience?
My experience is that they're not usually shocked. They're usually relieved that somebody gets it and it validates their experience of life. So, you know, if they've had twists and turns in their life, this non-linearity we talk about, which is one of the features of chaos, that small changes can have profound impacts down the road, or sometimes very large changes change nothing. They said, wow, somebody finally gets it. This is exactly how my life is going. And I didn't realize, I thought I was the odd one out, or I had to conform to something. Mm-hmm. And the other point is, it's funny you talk about the beach, because I live near a beach. I'm very blessed to live near that in Sydney. And one of my sort of fitness things I try to do is to walk along the beach a long, long way, about 15 kilometers, about 8 miles or 9 miles down to a place called Manly. And I walk along the sand. And the closer you get to the water's edge, the harder the sand is, which makes it easier to walk on. But I always think it's like what we call in chaos, the edge of chaos, because also you increase the risk of getting your trainers soaked. So in life, in sometimes you've got to find that edge. And of course, it's not a case of set and forget, because the tide will come in at different rates or be going out, and the waves, because of the constraints of the beach with the rocks or the dunes or the sand, will be in different places. So the water will run much further up the beach in certain places and not in others. So you have to continually monitor and continually adjust to be in this kind of optimal position. There's no one set optimal. There's no one set perfection. You're constantly having to change and adjust, and you make mistakes. And the more, you know, surfers fall off waves, you know, they pick the wrong waves. Something goes wrong with their balance. So I find, and again, it was going back to what I was saying right at the beginning, that oddly, where we expected people to be really challenged by this, most of the time they're not, because it's speaking to life as they experience it, not asking them to conform to some idealized textbook linear view of how life should go, or trying to force them, dare I say, into Donald Super's stages. And how dare you still be in exploration stage? You realize, you know, you should grow up. You're 50. What are you doing exploring? This is outrageous. You know, you should be in decline. Get back into decline, please. You know, and so, and I know that is probably an unfair wording up of Donald Super's theory, which is more complex than that. But the point is, I think that notion that people feel they have to sort of conform and everything has to be predictable and linear is wrong. Equally, and this is interesting, I've heard this more from theoreticians and academics than I've heard it from people in reality, is I once heard at a conference someone saying, oh, you know, Jim and Robert, they talk about unplanned events, but I like to sleep at night. It's a good joke. But in fact, it's also, it's incorrect, because it's underestimating people's capacity for dealing with chaos, and they're dealing with it all the time. You know, people, generally speaking, don't flee planes after the safety instructions are given out. People don't generally walk past a door that says fire exit and immediately panic. Some people might if they've got a severe anxiety disorder, but the majority of us actually have a sense of relief, if anything at all, that, oh, right, okay, there's a strategy for dealing with a situation should it not go out the way I want. Now, some people say that's a plan B, and what's new, Jim? We've always had plan Bs. But the point I'm making is, no, it's not about just a plan B. That's just another static plan. It's about continually planning. It's about process. It's about this constant exploration about, as I say, as Snowden calls it, sort of work out where you are, work out what seems to be the best next move, and then review, and then keep trying to do things which kind of lead to happiness or lead to success or lead to better places, without any guarantee that it's always going to work. And certainly what your last move is not going to necessarily work again, in the same way your last move in chess, if you keep repeating it, you're going to end up getting beaten by a half decent player in any time at all, and nature will beat you pretty quickly if you kind of think, right, I'll walk on this part of the beach, my feet won't get wet. Well, that's a recipe for getting your feet wet pretty quickly, because you have to be constantly doing that problem solving and moving on. And I think that fundamental shift, I think, is really important. And in fact, it's buried away, if you look for it, in the signals in other parts of our field, like the idea of lifelong learning and commitment to continually acquiring new knowledge and skills and continually being and staying open and staying curious. Those sorts of ideas have been around for a long time, but they haven't really been coherently included in a career development theory, we would argue, until then. So it's a big beast, this thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't think it actually causes people to be, I think the word you use is shock, and I don't think people are usually shocked by it.
Yeah. Yeah, I sort of see two waves in my practice. I've often worked with historically marginalized populations, people living in poverty, people of color here in the United States, and I've always found more traction with chaos theory of careers when they have less privilege, when they have fewer expectations of disruption. And so that has been a big part of my experience in session for more than a decade now. But what I'm finding in the last 3 years since the pandemic began is that the expectations of more privileged people have been shaken more. And yeah. I see a lot of embracing of that. We see it here in the United States in like the unionization efforts that are happening again for the first time in many years in many places. But just the expectation even of college graduates that are financially okay, living with parents, maybe living with roommates still, maybe, but are actively thinking about ideas of greater options than just which corporate ladder or which career ladder to plug into. And we have everything from, you know, these anti-capitalist movements to these run off and live off the land movements. And I'm seeing that in session now. In private practice in St. Louis, Missouri. I can see your head shaking very quickly. What would you like to say to that?
Facetiously, in a sense that the pandemic has been good for chaos business, that it's actually, you've got to resist the temptation to say, told you so. Yeah. But you make a really important point about privilege. I mean, one of the most extreme things you see in terms of privilege in some societies are these gated communities, which I know exist in places like Australia, in America, in England, and South Africa, to name a few. And that is, in a way, the ultimate example of trying to block out uncertainty and make the world certain by building albeit a very nice prison for yourself to live in. So it's a very radical attempt to control the immediate environment. People are of less privilege. You don't have to tell them that careers are uncertain if their experience is turning up to the labor hire every day to see whether they're going to get taken on or not. And if they're lucky, they get a day's work. And if they're not, they don't. You know, people have had that. And I've said this for donkey's years about, my grandmother working in the cotton mills of Lancashire, where young girls were scalped and killed because they had to climb into the machinery to clean these things out while they were operating. And from a working class Northern English background in the turn of the century, or the early part of the 20th century, don't talk to her about predictability of careers and control and following your passion or these other middle class kinds of ideas. I think it has reached up into, and we are seeing a real transformation of people's expectations of work and how it's done, where it's done, and why it's done, and for what reason. And we are beginning to see much closer scrutiny of power structures. Mm-hmm. And I think what's coming back onto the agenda, for those of us who've been around long enough, are issues to do with inequality in power, inequality in privilege and wealth, and the destructive impacts that they can have on societies. And again, if you do want a certainty, if you want a cast iron rule, historically, as I'm told, I'm not an historian, but I'm led to believe that where you've had very significant financial inequalities in societies, that has nearly always ended in either dictatorship or revolution. Yeah. So yeah. It's that's an interesting thing. And as we speak now with my European roots, with a major armed conflict in Europe, and I was brought up as a child near Coventry, which was bombed in the Second World War as an industrial center, and was brought up with tales of bombs dropping and bomb shelters, and we were told this was never really going to happen again and we must avoid it, et cetera, et cetera. And now, as a child, watching the nuclear bomb warning adverts, go and sit under a table,
I remember those drills myself.
And you have nightmares about this, and you think, well, we've thank God the world's got sane and we've gone beyond that, but who knows where we stand. So that uncertainty, I think, has never been more evident to all echelons of society. It has always been and ever present for the less privileged, but now things like as I say, the pandemic reached into every corner of society.
What's really resonating with me is, you know, it's really about awareness of what always was. And so even in when we were unaware, or if we were unaware, it's still influencing us dramatically. And I think that's where a lot of the mental health problems come from. So many clients in my clinical practice, finding a diagnosis or knowing the why behind the way they feel the way they do is such a pivotal moment to moving forward to a more positive future. And I think that that applies to career just as much as it applies to mental health issues personally.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting that as you were saying that, I was reading something recently about the possibility that we need to rethink some of these major ideas we've had about boundaries, for instance, in relationships. Mm-hmm. Because of course, chaos is all about, at the very least, semi-permeable boundaries or entanglement. And the point is that if you take an overly simplistic view of this boundary idea, and you might be doing it for very, very good reasons for self-protection, you can end up building another psychological prison for yourself, which can ultimately be self-destructive in terms of relationships going forward. I hate to say I'm not a relationship expert, but this is kind of my understanding. And I thought, and then you start to think about Brené Brown's interesting work down in Texas on vulnerability, and you start to think, okay, people are beginning to start moving back away from this idea that the answer is closed systems and trying to control everything, to recognizing that whether we like it or not, we're in open systems. And in fact, open systems are more resilient. They're not as brittle. Yeah. To use a Nassim Taleb kind of notion. I've thrown a whole bunch of different theories in there all hit.
Well, yeah, Brené Brown has this great quote that I use in session a lot I think she said, never take away someone's defense without already having something to replace it with. And so, yes, the defenses make us brittle. Yes, they are what are keeping us from a better life. But we need perspective. And we need the ability to do deeper work to build up the replacement for that defense so that the client is able to remove it without harming themselves. And I think that applies to career work as well. I'm very aware of the generous time that you're donating to us. I hope the listener is getting the same sense of me as why this is such an important theory to think about, to embrace. Maybe as we think about closing, and I want to ask this in a very specific way based on a conversation you and I've had off air. I don't care about a practitioner learning about your theory. How would someone that's interested after listening to this podcast, how would they get good? How would they become good at using chaos theory of careers in their work?
Well, I mean, read. There's a whole load of papers, not only by Bright and Pryor, Pryor and Bright, but that's a good starting point. The Chaos Theory of Careers book from 2011 is definitely a really good starting point for our theory. And I've been reading, in the special edition, Shelley Tien's publishing some interesting work on using indexes, and John Schlesinger is doing some really interesting and valuable work demonstrating how chaos ideas can be used effectively with students in university settings. And Lauren Pasquarella Daly has done some of that work with John in the past as well. So there's good American examples of this. So we're seeing some good practice around the place. But go and read those papers. I have, and this is going to sound very cheesy, and I wasn't intending to do this, but I through a company I'm involved in called Become Education, we run now an online 3-day course, which I run, and it's also done face-to-face if you happen to be in Australia, on career development, and particularly chaos theory is the big focus of that course. So that's another way of doing it. I still teach at the Australian Catholic University, a graduate certificate of that. That will be another way. And get out there and try these things out and apply to yourself the same philosophy of work out where you're at, and then try experiments, try things out. in non-critical situations, in low stakes, not high stakes situations to start with, as you develop more competence in the field. What I'd love to see is more people embracing this and researching this and developing this approach. This is not, I'm not here to sort of put a trademark on this and sort of turn it into some kind of, you know, huge enterprise, but this, I believe this is the approach that we need to take in our field. And training people in these kinds of approaches, I think, is absolutely critical if we're going to take the field forward in a really sensible way. That doesn't mean abandoning everything in the past. We're not iconoclasts, but it does mean we've got to get away from this overly simplistic thinking. And any field, any discipline that says all of the career processes and all of the theories were fully developed in the early part of the 20th century has got a real problem. You would never go to a doctor who was still practicing techniques solely from sort of 1935. It doesn't mean that some of the ideas that came up with in that time or even earlier don't have some validity, but surely they've been improved, nuanced, or sometimes flatly rejected and changed. And that's what I think is really important. Myself and Robert have never said we've got all the answers and never believe anyone who says we do. But we do think that we're on the right lines with this kind of work, and there's loads more to fill in the gaps that others can do along the way. And I continue to do with my students as well and my colleagues around the world.
Yeah. And that awareness and that humility that you have, if we fast forward another 50 years, chaos theory of careers will likely have been a stepping stone for another thing, a next thing. And so we can honor the past while being humble in the face of an uncertain future might be a good way to put that.
Yeah, and we said that when we started. We said it, you know, and we actually said, I think in 20 years, this stuff may well have been surpassed. Now, it hasn't, but, and I think that really is one of the issues that we have in our field more generally, is we need a much bigger critical mass of people doing high quality research. And that needs to be additive. It needs to build on what's there. We don't need to keep going off in 1,000 different directions like someone's dropped a match in a cracker box. There is an evidence base. There are some very good sound concepts out there. And it's not about necessarily prematurely trying to marry them all together and unifying them. I mean, physics has been trying that for 200 years and it hasn't managed to get there.
Right.
And we are nowhere near, you know, we're in physics terms, we're probably still in the 19th century. So, but what we do need to do is bring on a lot more people to do that. And that isn't just a postgraduate level, that's undergraduate level as well. It means more honours theses, undergraduate theses in this area. That's the academic side of it. And teaching people in our field how to appreciate research and how to critically read it and get away from this kind of potted sort of, you know, here's half a page on one theory, here's half a page on another, and you can use this one on a Tuesday and this on a Friday. That is not the approach to training people, and that's not the approach to developing the field. That's a polemic point of view, but anyway, sure. That's...
Well, and if I can add my own couple of recommendations, I really think that we would benefit from being more specific in our mentorship and our supervision in our practice. And full disclosure, that's part of what I do for a living. I work with a university, for example, where their clinical mental health staff of counselors, social workers called me in to do career specific clinical supervision because there was so many career phenomenon in the mental health practice that they had. Yeah. And I think it's, and I've seen examples and I've provided examples, the same thing of, you know, let me be your mentor to talk about chaos theories of career, or find a clinical supervisor if you're preparing for licensure as a practitioner that understands a theory, any theory really, that you're interested in. But for me, it's, I think, more intentionality and specificity in pursuing approaches to counseling versus the smorgasbord approach is something that I really want to explore in the next phase of my career.
Yeah, and I think that's, I mean, one of the challenges is it's great that people are picking up on the ideas, but at some stage I'm probably going to have to sort of jump in and sort of actually start coaching and say, well, actually, no, you think you're talking chaos or complexity, you're not. Or you're ticking a box and saying, oh, yes, we acknowledge complexity, but let's go back to a simple reductionist approach. Okay. People are crying out for this. In my own professional practice, when I see people who have been suddenly injured or hurt on duty, in a medical legal setting, I mean, only very recently, I've had several clients say to me things like, oh, we've always been encouraged to believe what we were doing was totally unique, and we don't have any transferable skills. There's nothing else I can do. It's the end of my working career because of this injury. And it's not the case. You know, it simply isn't the case. It should be the end of their career. It may well be the end of them working in a particular occupation. But unfortunately, this is the hangover from this idea of fit and this idea of this perfectionistic view that there is only one ideal job for me that matches my interests, or here's my rank order list of number one to number 10. The evidence for that has always been shaky, and it's dangerous psychologically, and we're paying the price for that. But still the field tenaciously grips on to early 20th century thinking, and we need to move on. As I say, it's about you know, standing out as well as fitting in.
Well, Jim, I think that if we were ever to do a second episode, we could maybe analyze practitioners and scholars in the field from a chaos theory of careers perspective to say why they're holding on so tight. But that is not something that we have time for today. I did want to give, is there any closing thing? I'm going to include some of the resources that you've talked about, Become Education, and in the links of the show notes. But is there any last words you'd like to have in this episode for the listener?
I think don't be afraid of theory. Don't be afraid of complexity, because the world is complex. And don't believe anyone who says they have all the answers, including Jim Bright. You know, think for yourself. Have the confidence to try things, to be curious. And keep experimenting and innovating in terms of your own learning and your practice, and don't fall into doing the same things in the same way or believing that you somehow don't have what it takes to change the field or change your own practice. Because if you don't, who does? It has to start from you, and it has to start from that perspective. And it's okay to try things which don't work, including with clients, within reason. You do need to innovate your work, I believe, and you need to try to constantly improve it. And I do think that I would encourage you to embrace the chaos theory of careers and read it with an open mind, because I think those of you who don't know it, I think you'll find there's some value in it.
Well said, and I couldn't agree more. It has been, for me, one of two theories that have really just changed my perspective on the world and the way that I do my work. And so I thank you so much for that work, and to your team, to Robert, and to the rest of the team as well. And thank you so much for the time today. Until next time, this is Brian Hutchison signing off.